But what I thought I would do is talk a little bit just in terms of background about Denver Water and some of the challenges that we face as a utility, and some of the responses that we've made and the way we've had to kind of change course throughout the course of our history as we seek to provide a safe and secure and environmentally responsible water supply to our customers. So just in terms of background, and now I am going to try and see if I can't share my screen. Denver Water serves the greater Denver metropolitan area. I hope you can.
We could see it.
That might help a little bit. And our service area includes not only the city and county of Denver, but includes many of the suburbs outside of Denver. So we generally serve north of C-470 and east of, say, Golden, and south of the 36 corridor and east of Aurora. We serve about 1.5 million customers. We have about 1,100 employees, and our structure is really quite unique. We were established in 1918 under the city charter that was authorized by the state legislature. And unlike most water utilities in the country, we are not actually part of city government. So we do not report to city council. We aren't beholden to the politics of the city. We were expressly established under the charter to be non-political, to be able to take a long-term view. So we are a totally separate, unique enterprise of the city. We operate independently. We have our own employee base. We have our own pension system. We're able to float bonds and issue debt on our own, separate from the city. And we're funded solely by water sales, which are basically customers' bills, by hydropower revenues. We generate quite a bit of hydropower in our system, and by developer fees. So we're not tax-based. We're really fee-based. I like to joke that under the charter, our obligation is to provide the best service at the lowest cost. And I like to joke that our business model is that we have a monopoly, so there's no competition for customers within our service area. We provide a product that is absolutely essential to human life, so everybody's got to, for life-sustaining purposes, use our product. And yet, we have to convince our customers not to use as much of the product as they might otherwise due to water conservation. And we have to keep our prices as low as we possibly can. So if any of you are coming out of business school or are familiar with business practice, it's kind of a unique and different business model, which provides a somewhat of a challenge for us in terms of balancing the price of what we charge with the long-term sustainability and reliability of our system. We have about a $320 million operating budget and about a $180 million capital budget this year. And are currently planning or undertaking a number of major capital projects in our system. In fact, this current period is the most intensive capital development period in probably since the 1950s. We just finished a redevelopment of our operations complex, our headquarters complex in Denver, at a cost of about $200 million, and I'll talk a little bit about that. We're in the process of constructing a brand new state-of-the-art water treatment plant on Highway 93 between Golden and Boulder at a cost of about $600 million. And we're planning for the enlargement of Gross Reservoir at the north end of our system at a cost of about $464 million. So That together with other projects over the next 5 years, we're planning to spend about $1.5 billion in capital projects on enhancements and upgrades to our system. Looking at our system, it's a very diverse and widespread water system that provides service to our community in Denver. Here's Denver right here, just to orient you. The dashed line here is the Continental Divide. We receive about 80% of our water supply from the area on the west side of the Continental Divide, where Dillon Reservoir is, Dillon, Silverthorne, Breckenridge, the Blue and the Snake Rivers, and 10 Mile Creek go into Dillon Reservoir. Water is diverted from Dillon Reservoir through the Roberts Tunnel into the North Fork of the South Platte River. We have reservoirs in the South Platte Basin, Antero, 11 Mile, Cheeseman. Water goes through Chatfield. We have water in Chatfield and is treated at two treatment plants in our service area. Again, about 80% of our water supply comes from this combination of facilities in these two watersheds. The north end of our system originates in Grand County in the Fraser River Basin through a series of canals and tunnels, as well as from the Williams Fork River in western Colorado, and is diverted through the Moffett Tunnel into South Boulder Creek, where Gross Reservoir is located, and then is piped across to our Moffett Treatment Plant and soon to be Northwater Treatment Plant at the north end of our system. So about 20% of our water supply comes from that north end of the system. So very diverse and widespread. We operate in 12 counties in Colorado. And we receive about half of our water supply from the Colorado River watershed in the Fraser River Basin and the Blue River Basin, and about half of our water supply on the east side of the Continental Divide in the South Platte River and South Boulder Creek. So developing these new supplies and collecting and treating and distributing water to 1.5 million people is really complex in and of itself. But where we find ourselves today in history really, I think, magnifies those challenges. And so I think it's important, and to me anyway, as a water geek, to be, it's interesting to consider the history of Denver Water and kind of how the role of water utilities has emerged over the decades and has changed over the decades. So as I mentioned, Denver Water was established in 1918 under the city charter as an enterprise system. We are not a regulated utility, so we're not under the regulation of the Public Utilities Commission. We really operate by a social contract, if you will, in terms of our customers and our ability to serve those customers reliably and in an affordable way. We're managed by a 5-member board of water commissioners who are appointed for 6-year terms by the mayor. If you look at the development of water supply in Denver, it's been an interesting journey. Denver was first supplied by water by a series of private competing water companies, and they really did not do a very good job of overall serving the customers in the city of Denver. And so as a result, Denver Water was established as a governmental entity in 1918 because of the inadequate water supply, flood damages, and inadequacy and inability to finance the development of the type of system that we needed. And I think if you look at historically at water development in the early 20th century, the way I describe it is that it was both linear and monolithic. So what do I mean by that? It was linear in the sense that Denver had a limited water supply locally. And so what planners would do in the early 20th century is simply do a linear projection of, we have so much water available to us now. We have a certain population that we think we're going to need to serve. There's a gap there. And so then we need to just go out and find more water. And so Denver and utilities throughout the West, if you're familiar with Chinatown from the LA story, would simply go farther and farther afield to develop water. So that's why you see that the first reservoir that, that Denver developed, Cheeseman Reservoir, on the South Platte River, when the Moffett Tunnel train tunnel was built, Denver Water had the idea of utilizing the pilot tunnel, the pilot bore for the Moffett Tunnel, and developing a water supply from western Colorado. So we reached out into the Fraser River Basin. And then in the 1960s, actually starting in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, began thinking about the concept of a reservoir in the Blue River Basin and a tunnel under the Continental Divide. When the Roberts Tunnel was built in the 1940s, it was the longest tunnel then built in the world. And so that comes to the monolithic part. Denver Water, as a home rule city, was really beholden to no one and viewed itself as having the mandate and the responsibility to do whatever it took to develop a water supply for what was perceived to be a booming population need in the Denver metropolitan area. And so literally, the Denver Water Board would, without regard to local population on the western slope or without regard to the environmental consequences of what they were doing, would go out and through lawsuits and just sheer will overrun local communities such as the town of Dillon, which literally had to be moved and rebuilt because it was inundated by Dillon Reservoir, just run over, frankly, those local communities. Denver Water also engaged in a series of legal battles with the Western Slope over the operation of Green Mountain Reservoir, which is a key facility for Western Colorado and Dillon Reservoir. And so I lived in Glenwood Springs for about 30 years. Jennifer mentioned I ran the State Department of Natural Resources. I was a lawyer in Western Colorado, and hating the Denver Water Board is just part of the DNA of anybody in Western Colorado. And for good reason, because Denver Water simply would run over any opposition in that monolithic linear way. Denver Water had, as I mentioned, this view of a mandate to supply the entire Denver metropolitan area, and developed a plan beginning again in the early 20th century to build a gigantic series of reservoirs at the confluence of the North Fork of the South Platte River and the South Platte River called Two Forks. Through a long series of opposition in the late 1980s and early 1990s, the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency exercised his authority to veto the permit for the development of that Two Forks project. And that really was a game changer in terms of the Denver Water Board and the approach that the Denver Water Board took to its perceived mandate. The Denver Water Board literally took a step back, issued a series of proclamations that basically said it would no longer seek to serve the Denver metropolitan area, and would only enter into cooperative arrangements if it was in Denver Water's interest. And it was really a blow to the psyche and the culture at Denver Water that had grown up in that linear and monolithic way. And as an organization, I think Denver Water was kind of lost for quite some time in the 1990s as it sought to regain its footing and determine kind of what the path forward was going to be in the wake of the Two Forks veto. A couple of events really served as a wake-up call, though, to Denver Water. One was, were two catastrophic wildfires, the Buffalo Creek Fire and the Hayman Fire in the late 1990s, early 2000s, which burned huge areas of upstream from Denver Water's key facility at Strontia Springs Reservoir, and caused vast amounts of sediment to come into Strontia Springs Reservoir in the wake of significant rainstorms that occurred in the aftermath of those fires, and caused water quality problems and sediment loading, and to this day threatens the integrity of Strontia Springs Reservoir. And so we realized at the time that our system was subject to climate change, to catastrophic events, and was vulnerable because this area in particular at Strontia Springs Reservoir, if you can see my cursor, was a pinch point for literally 80% of our water supply. So we were vulnerable. And then in 2003, we had what was, except for a March miracle snowstorm, which was going to be one of the worst droughts in our history. And in that drought, we literally almost ran out of water in the north end of our system, supplied by the Fraser River and South Boulder Creek. And so we realized that not only was our system vulnerable to catastrophic failure, but was also imbalanced. It wasn't really diversified. If you think of water supply, it's similar to an investment portfolio where you want the proper diversification of different sources so that you can withstand different events and still be able to supply your customers with water. And so in the wake of those two things, Denver Water developed a kind of a three-pronged strategy. One was to really ramp up our efforts toward water conservation, recognizing that we needed to better and more efficiently use the water supplies that we have. The second was to propose to enlarge Gross Reservoir in South Boulder Creek to be able to increase and rectify that imbalance problem. And the third was to reuse as much of our water supplies as we possibly can. So under Colorado law, any water user in one basin is able to totally reuse to extinction any water that's imported from another basin. So all the Colorado River water that we have coming into our system, we get to reuse and reuse and continually reuse until extinction. So we have built a recycled treatment plant and a number of gravel pit storages, reservoirs below Denver that allows us to release water and exchange, recapture that water that has already been used once, then release it for exchange purposes farther up into our system. So then we've developed a number of other strategies to meet those challenges of the system challenges that I just spoke of, to meet our responsibilities to supply growth in the Denver metropolitan area, to meet the challenges of climate change, and to meet the challenge of a looming crisis on the Colorado River. We have gone from the typical or traditional linear approach to water supply planning to a planning of what we call scenario planning to assure sustainable water supplies in the face of deep uncertainty. And under scenario planning, we don't just assume a certain population projection and a certain water supply projection. We understand that not only are those projections going to be wrong, but also our ability to serve water to our customers is dependent on more than just population growth and hydrology. It's dependent on the economy. It's dependent on potentially catastrophic events like a pandemic. It's dependent on how growth occurs, where it occurs, what it looks like. So many factors play into our how, when, and where we develop water supplies and how we supply those supplies to our customers. So under scenario planning, we picture what the future might look like 50 years from now. Will people be living in the suburbs? Will people be living in the inner city? Will our economy thrive, or will we sustain economic economic woes. How will climate change affect not only the amount of water, but the demands in our system, the timing of runoff, how much snow we're going to have versus how much rainfall we're going to have, how climate change will affect catastrophic events. And we kind of mix and match those and create different futures that translate to different ways that we can meet those futures. And then our job is to be able to essentially supply water reliably in the face of each of those futures. And as we move in our planning process, we look for signposts as to potentially what type of a future we might be headed toward as we move forward. And I talked about diversity in our system and the number of things that we've done and the water conservation and reuse programs that we've developed, which have been a big shift from that traditional linear approach. We've also developed a new approach when we do develop traditional water projects. And I'll use Gross Reservoir as an example. As I mentioned, following 2003, we proposed to enlarge Gross Reservoir, which was planned for enlargement at the time it was built. And I gave you a couple of the reasons why we decided to do that. Well, that was 17 years ago, and Gross Reservoir still isn't built. We've been 17 years in the permitting process, going through a number of different federal permits. We just secured our final federal permit this year from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. But aside from that, going through the permitting process, I think that the way that Denver Water developed this proposal is important in that we completely went away from the monolithic mode of water development that I mentioned earlier. The Denver Water Board decided that we really weren't going to build a new water project unless we actually received the support of the Western Slope from key environmental organizations in terms of how that reservoir was built and how we dealt with the environmental impacts of that development. And that really represented a new ethic for Denver Water, where we recognized that if we, in a sense, foul our own nest by destroying the aquatic environment from which we are securing water supply, we're doing a disservice to our customers in the future. We need clean, healthy watersheds. We need clean, healthy aquatic environments that are supplying our water, because that's the sustainable way to go. And so we reached out to the Western Slope and began a series of negotiations that involved not only the impacts of Gross Reservoir, but the impacts of the historical way that we developed water in the past. So the operations of Dillon Reservoir and the operations of our system in the Fraser River system, and historically how those impacts would be dealt with. And through a series of mediated negotiations, we actually developed a common vision, not only with the Western Slope, but with a couple of key environmental organizations, Trout Unlimited, American Rivers being a couple of them, where we established a common goal that, in particular, the Fraser River system impacted by Gross Reservoir development would be better off with the project than without the project. And so it's kind of a bit counterintuitive to say that you're going to pull water out of a watershed, remove that water, and have the system, the natural system, be better off as a result. But what we did was we put on the table two key things. One is we committed to operate our Fraser River system in a way that benefits the natural environment, the aquatic environment of the Fraser River. So as we move water through our collection system, we have the ability to add water to streams in the Fraser River system to mitigate temperature impacts, for example. And we agreed to a process called learning by doing, where we literally sit down with the Western Slope and on a monthly, even daily basis, come to agreements on how we can better operate and manage our system for the benefit of the environment in the Fraser River. The other thing we did was commit to about $25 million in both Grand County and Summit County to environmental enhancement projects that are over and above what would otherwise be required under our permitting process, and agreed with entities all the way down to the Colorado state line to deal with the impacts of the removal of water from the Colorado River system through our system. Going back to the service area map, we also agreed that essentially this service area is the service area that we will operate in the future. So we agreed that service area is now fixed. We're not going to look to expand that service area. We agreed to redouble our efforts toward reuse and efficient use of water in our service area. And as a result, we have secured the support of Western Colorado and those key environmental organizations for the development of Gross Reservoir. Looking forward, we have submitted a local land use permit application to Boulder County. The project is obviously very controversial in Boulder County, and so we'll see where that process goes. But we are hopeful and prepared to move forward with the development of that project. And I think it represents really a new way of doing business.
Jim, I'm going to stop you there and see if there are any questions. I'll look to the students first to say, really interesting how they've changed the way they do business. Mattia, go ahead.
My question is about the Stronta problems. Are y'all doing any work to like mitigate that, or are y'all just monitoring it?
We're mitigating that on two fronts. First of all, we realized that first of all that the watersheds that serve our service area are just as much a part of our infrastructure as the gray infrastructure of the concrete of the dams and the collection facilities and the treatment plants. So the health of that watershed is critically important. We think it's actually cheaper to treat water in those watersheds before it even comes to our treatment plants than it is to treat it in our treatment plants. And so we have partnered with the United States Forest Service, which owns much of the land in this watershed, to develop a program called From Forest to Faucets, where between Denver Water and the Forest Service, we're each equally contributing $60 million over a 10-year period to do forest treatments to reduce the threat of catastrophic wildfire. And as an example of the success of that program, part of the program was the development of some forest treatments near Silverthorn, Colorado, just below Dillon Reservoir. And there was a fire there two or three years ago called the Buffalo Mountain Fire. We had just before that invested about $1 million in forest treatments on that fire. And through fire modeling, they were able to show that $1 million investment mitigated over $100 million in damage that would have occurred if we had not done those treatments. We're also partnering with local watershed groups and counties to deal with other watershed health issues like septic tanks, mine pollution, sources of water supplies to partner to foster the health of those watersheds. And then finally, I mentioned we've got a lot of sediment coming into Strancha Springs Reservoir. We haven't quite figured out how to deal with all that sediment. From an engineering standpoint, we brought in a company from Louisiana that was a dredging company to just dredge that material out, because we can't just send it downstream. There's Waterton Canyon there, which is a sensitive environmental area, and so we can't really truck it out. So we had the idea of dredging it, and it turned out that this company was used to dredging silt, but the sediment that's in this reservoir is granite. It's essentially like sharp, pointed material that burned up all the pumps, ate holes in all the hoses, and so that idea didn't work. So we're looking for ways to manage not only the sediment that's in there, but sediment upstream. Sediment traps, trying to prevent the sediment from getting in the first place is one thing that we're doing.
And it's something I imagine Denver is going to get a lot of calls from Eastern Colorado now that we have the fires and going to have to be dealing with the debris that comes out of those fires, exactly as Denver had to.
Yeah.
Any other questions for the students? And Rio, I think we caught your question. So, but she has another one. Rhea De La Vista says, curious to know if you think that the Basin Roundtable process has been helpful with this transition.
I think that Denver Water's approach really operated independently from the Basin Roundtables. We negotiated directly with the major political organizations on the Western Slope, the Colorado River Water Conservation District, and county governments in particular. So in terms of this process that I described here, the roundtables were really not part of that process. They have dealt mostly with issues of state water plan, lots of concern remaining about future Trans Mountain diversion development in Colorado. I happen to think that we're not going to see, we're going to see very few, if any. There's one that's being proposed by Colorado Springs and Aurora in Homestead Creek in Eagle County that I think will be very controversial. But in direct answer to your question, no, the Basin Roundtables really weren't engaged or pushing forward on these efforts.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Go ahead.
So the other thing that we've done is work to really demonstrate, I think, the future of water use in the 21st century. I mentioned the campus that we developed in Denver, if I can pull up that one. This is a rendering of our brand new administration building, and you can see the campus behind that was developed. There are warehouses and trade shops, a meter shop, number of operational facilities. It's about a 35-acre campus located just off of I-25.
So, Jim, we're not seeing it.
Oh, you're not?
We're not seeing it, huh? No.
Let's see if I can. I'm sharing my screen. Let me.
Sometimes I have to take it down and start over.
Yeah, maybe I should do that. Let's start over. Here we go. How about that?
It said you started screen sharing, but nothing's coming up.
You guys there?
Yeah, we're here.
I lost Zoom there for a minute.
Oh, okay. Now we're here.
Can you see my screen?
We can see you.
Okay.
I can't see your screen.
Let me try and share my screen again.
Okay.
And hopefully we won't lose Zoom. How about that?
There we go. Got it.
Nice. So, yeah, these are the trade shops, as I mentioned. It's about a 35-acre campus. This is the 8th Avenue Viaduct right here. And this is this new building. So as I mentioned, we wanted this campus not just to be an operations campus, but to demonstrate what water will look like in the future. So this administration building, which is home to about 600, or was home before the pandemic, home to about 600 employees, is net zero energy. We developed a rainwater capture system to utilize rainwater for irrigation. Now, you may know that rainwater capture is illegal in Colorado. So we actually filed for a water right for to allow us to do rainwater capture. I think it's the first and only rainwater capture water right that's been filed in Colorado. We developed an in-building wastewater treatment system. So there's a, what we call an eco machine in the lobby of the administration building, where we take all the wastewater that's been generated from the building and reuse it for both irrigation and toilet flushing. And that was an interesting process because even though those that type of technology is used throughout the world, ours was the first building in Colorado, and we really wanted to be kind of the tip of the spear to demonstrate not only the technologies, but to understand where the pitfalls were from a permitting and governmental standpoint, and there were many. We had to have the governor intervene with the state plumbing board. The Water Quality Control Division at the Colorado Department of Health was not enthusiastic about our using treated wastewater for toilet flushing. We went to the Colorado Legislature, and the Colorado Legislature passed a directive to the Health Department to add toilet flushing and other uses for reusable water. The building inspectors that came into the building had never seen anything like this before, and they really didn't know what to do with it. So we had to go through the local politics of the building inspectors. But we did it. We accomplished what we wanted to do. We got a number of regulatory changes. Another interesting aspect of this building is that with the net zero energy concept, we're doing heat exchange from a looped water line from our own water supply. So we're using our own water for heat exchange in the building through a central utility plant that serves the entire campus. So this is the most advanced and sustainable building that's yet been built in Colorado. And again, it's part of the way that the new way that Denver Water has approached all of our operations in terms of being environmentally responsible. I mentioned the North Water Treatment Plant that we're currently building. When they began the design of that plant, it's located right below a dam that we have at Ralston Reservoir, and we have the ability to generate hydropower in the head between the top of the dam and that treatment plant. And I asked the engineers if it would be possible to develop that treatment system, that treatment plant, literally off the grid. So we would not be dependent on the grid, and we'd also be, from an environmental standpoint, totally sustainable. The engineers looked at me like I was nuts. They said, well, you can't do that. There's too much risk. And I said, well, why don't you try? And as a result, they did a number of things. They, first of all, increased the overall efficiency of the plant. So they made it much smaller, tighter, more confined, more module, more flexible. But they also got the technology and the energy generating capabilities of the plant to the point that we're now hooked up to the grid. But the reason we're hooked up to the grid is because we're actually a net energy producer at that plant. We'll be selling energy back to the grid from that water treatment plant as we develop energy through the treatment process. I mentioned watershed health and the importance of forest treatments and watershed health in our operations. It's a whole new commitment to watersheds as part of our infrastructure. We've also been engaging with state and federal agencies in improving Colorado River operations. I mentioned that the Colorado River is about one half of our water supply. And if there is a failure in the Colorado River through climate change or mismanagement that results in the lower basin states of California, Arizona, and Nevada calling for water from the upper basin, that literally means that Denver, in order to comply with that, we stand to lose half of our water supply. So we've got a big stake in the operation of the Colorado River, which serves seven states, the United States and Mexico, a vast agricultural economy, 40 million people throughout the West. It's an overworked river, as Jennifer well knows. She did a lot of work on the Colorado River. And Denver Water has a big stake. So we've actually actively been engaging with the state of Colorado and the other basin states toward improving operations and creating greater water supply security in the system. And then finally, I think that you know, part of the effort of a water utility to kind of end, I guess, where I began is not just collecting, treating, and delivering water to our customers, but because of the nature of water in the West, because of the challenges that we face with growth and climate change, it's our responsibility to engage much more broadly, geographically, through different policy arenas, in the development of research, education, innovation, and policy in the West. And so as a result of that ethic, the other thing that we're doing is partnering with CSU in the development of the hydro building at the Spur campus in Denver at the National Western Center. We're going to build a new water quality lab at the hydro building and utilize that to kind of co-function with CSU on research and education. And we also are planning to participate in innovation initiatives that CSU will lead. And then finally, partner with CSU in the Water Policy Center at the Hydro building, which will look at all the water policy issues that we face in Colorado and west-wide in terms of sustainable development of water, watershed health, the interactions between urban and ag, and sustaining healthy agricultural economies, as well as issues of technology and research and how those are impacted by policy. So a much kind of broader, more holistic viewpoint, as opposed to the linear, monolithic days of old we were facing. And I think that's just the reality of what we're looking at as a water utility. So with that, Jennifer, I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Okay, there's a few questions that have been lined up, but Johanna, I'm going to go to your question first. Why don't you go ahead and ask Jim?
I was just wondering if you guys are working on any aquifer storage and recovery projects currently?
We are. We have done some pilot boreholes in the within our service area with varying degrees of promise. It's a program that because of cost and other priorities, we've gone a little bit more slowly on, but it's something we are pursuing as an option for water supply development.
Do any of the other students have questions? Okay, I'm going to open it up. Ed, you asked a question about curtailment on the Colorado River. Do you want to go ahead and ask Jim your question?
I'm sure. I was just wondering, Dillon Reservoir seems to be a vulnerability because it's a big reservoir on the west slope. So if there's a curtailment, is it a risk that you would basically have to release a lot of water out of it? So on the flip side, would it be better if you had more big reservoirs on the Front Range because they wouldn't be subject to call or curtailments? You would have a larger reserve, so like a Two Forks or gross expansion.
Yeah, one could take that position. I think that it would be expensive, probably from a permitting standpoint, very difficult to do. Certainly, I would take the position in that event that water is in our possession and we're going to use it. But, you know, I think that there is an argument for additional storage in the face of kind of for the reasons I talked about with gross reservoir, because with climate change, we're going to be facing different patterns of release. But I think that developing major storage on the eastern slope to kind of hold water over here, as opposed to a Colorado River call, is a bit short-sighted in that I think we can avoid, as seven states, the kind of catastrophic situation of a compact violation. Certainly, I think that every state seems committed to that approach. And so I'm putting all of our energy toward avoiding all of that from happening in the first place.
Jim, would you mind unsharing your screen, taking your screen share off? Yeah. Now I get a sense. Rio, you had a question for Jim. Go ahead.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah, Jim, I heard more about the scenario planning at Water Congress earlier this year, and just thinking within your service area, beyond your service area, how can we meet these future water demands when our population is going to double? I mean, as the population could well increase within your service area.
Mm-hmm.
And then with climate change, how to do that with minimizing environmental impact? You know, is the reuse have a bigger future role? What are some of your projections about how we're going to do that?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. Part of what I talk about in Colorado is if we grow the next 5 million people the way we grew the last 5 million people, it's not going to be sustainable. And the state water plan did utilize a lot of the scenario planning techniques that Denver Water has utilized in terms of developing some of the challenges that are outlined in that state water plan. I really believe that, you know, we're not going to stop people from coming to Colorado. So it's really a matter of, I think, how we grow as opposed to whether we grow. I think that we need to grow a lot more efficiently, a lot more densely, both in terms of water use, but also in terms of not chewing up valuable productive agricultural land, as not to mention the rural economies and social patterns that are so important to Colorado. And so the interconnection and the tie between land use and water has been difficult to broach because Colorado is such a local control state, and communities are just going to grow their way they want to grow. And so I think, frankly, until and unless we have some more centralized processes in terms of how we grow in Colorado from a regulatory standpoint, it's going to be a real challenge. Because certainly from a water supply standpoint, we can't keep going the way we're going. And I mean, sprawl is just the enemy of efficient water use.
Well, that's where I was headed with it. So thank you. I mean, are we going to get our political will to do that kind of planning and, you know, still give people their valuation of their property without, you know, using it all up and then the very place we love is kind of lost. We've all seen it happen in places we love,
yeah,
in ways that aren't sustainable. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. It is a great question, Rio. I also had put over the chat, I don't know if everybody saw it, and Jim, I know you didn't because you were busy talking about Patty Limerick's book, A Ditch in Time. How I thought that did a very decent job of showing the evolution of Denver and how they approached item sorts of things.
Yeah. Well, I'm a big fan of Patty's, and I think she did a great job with that book. For those of you who haven't read it, it's a book you don't have to read from cover to cover, and you would think that the history of a water utility would be not the most exciting subject to be reading about, but if you've heard her speak, she writes the same way. It's just really an engaging style about the way she writes, and it's the kind of book you can pick up and read one part or read another part, or you don't have to just read it cover to cover. But it is, I think, a very engaging history and very, I think, balanced history of Denver Water.
In fact, I think Patty was changed her mind a bit about Denver Water in the course of that book, at least from what I've heard her say on a couple different occasions.
Yep, I think she did. Yeah, you know, we all come in with preconceptions about, you know, what we're going to be writing about or whatever. And so, yeah, I think she did change her mind in some respects.
So we have another question in chat here. Given the great amount of community water systems in the U.S., what's your view on system consolidation? And should larger systems think about absorbing smaller ones, kind of an economies of scale?
Yeah, it's a good question. There are over 50,000 different water supply systems in the United States. And a lot of them are not very adequate. They don't have the finances to be able to reliably and sustainably serve their customers. They face water quality issues. They face the challenges of politics. I mentioned that we're really lucky in our governance structure at Denver Water. But if you're a water utility and a city council is pulling away from your revenues to fix streets or do other things unrelated to water supply, it doesn't give you the ability to maintain your own system. So this issue of consolidation is obviously being addressed both nationally. It's in President-elect Biden's view as an issue for water. There was a report that just came out within the last 6 months, I'd say, in California that looked at the issue of consolidation of water supply systems in California. I think there's a growing movement toward consolidation. You look at our service area and there are some 60 different little systems that we serve. Everything from what we call total service, which we do everything for that district the same as we would do for the city and county of Denver, to a master meter, which is we just send them water and it's their responsibility to deal with it. And so there are some inadequate systems in the Denver metropolitan area that we're serving as well through the structure that we have.
Jim, another question that I had missed and somebody reminded me of it, and that is, as temperatures rise and forest and brush consume more water, do you see a role for forest treatments to mitigate stream flow declines?
I think that's all part of watershed health. The treatments that we're engaged in and the activities that we're engaged in, because it's true. It's certainly, we saw that with the runoff this last year with soil moisture causing very low runoff, even with a pretty good snowpack this year. And we're going to keep seeing that moving forward. We're going to see different challenges in terms of predicting our water supplies and being able to plan on how much water we're going to get. We do a lot of calculating in terms of what the yield to our system is going to be given snowpack moisture and the snowpack depth. I think that's one of the reasons we're really focused on watershed health is we need to be a lot more proactive in terms of how we manage those watersheds.
Rio, why don't you go ahead and ask your other question?
Okay. I was just wondering, Jim, do you feel like your, I would call fairly progressive approaches have had a good influence or being adopted by the other utilities around the Denver area since your service area is now set? There's a lot of other ones. We hear about some of the collaboration going on with those, but how do you see that?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, we're part of a group of utilities up and down the Front Range called the Front Range Water Council, where we talk about these issues. Northern Colorado Water Conservancy District, Colorado Springs are involved in similar forest treatment issues as the ones that we've engaged in. I think all the utilities up and down the Front Range are focused on water conservation and the need to conserve water supplies. So I think that because we serve 25% of the state's population and because we have fairly significant resources at Denver Water, we have, I think, both the opportunity and the responsibility to be leaders on some of these issues. And so that's really another reason why we have undertaken that effort. We engage nationally and even internationally with other water utilities as well. We've got a lot to learn from other world utilities. And so, you know, I'm personally involved in conversations with water utility managers really all over the world in terms of the challenges that we all face as water utilities. Yeah, we have the opportunity to learn and engage and hopefully lead going forward.
So, Jim, we're probably about ready to wrap up, but there's one last question here. What would you say are the biggest challenges when addressing the implementation of emerging technologies such as AMI?
Traditionally, utilities have been very slow to adopt emerging technologies. Utilities, because we're really in the public health business, it's not an area where we're anxious to experiment. So we are kind of slow. We've been slow adopters of emerging technologies. I think that's changing. We're becoming more, as these technologies are becoming more and more available, artificial intelligence, going to the cloud-based services, utilizing computer models for asset management, for example. We're looking at artificial intelligence to look at our pipe replacement programs. So it's kind of a interesting way to approach our over 3,000 miles of pipe in our system, all built at different times, all built at different materials, all breaking and deteriorating at different rates. So we have to really utilize a lot of sophisticated technology to prioritize how, when, and where we replace that pipe, so we just don't do it kind of randomly. The treatment technologies that we're using at this new treatment plant are largely based on artificial intelligence. So we are beginning to adapt more and more of these emerging technologies going forward.
And here I thought a lawyer wouldn't be able to answer that question. Well, Jim, there are a lot of people on the chat who are thanking you very much for the tour of your campus. We look forward to actually seeing it sometime once all this is over. And I just can't thank you enough for spending the hour with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks, Jennifer. Appreciate it.
All right. And with that, we'll have a class next week, and that'll wrap it up. Thank you all. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you.